My name is Charlie Wickham. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I can't tell which came first. And I'm glad to be here.
Hi, Charlie!
That'll do. I'd like to thank Richard and everyone else, and Aaliyah, for a phenomenal job putting this together. I've never been to an adult child conference, an adult child celebration. And it's quite a thrill to see all these people here who really want to get better. And I'm really glad that I get a chance to share where I came from, what happened to me, what the heck happened to me. It's a mystery sometimes. I wake up and I go, what am I? How did I get here? What happened? I claim my start date in both programs on the same day. And that would be, we think, the 19th of August in 1981. And it was a very simple problem that most children of alcoholics will end up with. They have an alcoholic with them. Whether they're an alcoholic or not is unimportant, because we need to have an alcoholic, and if we can't be one, we'll find one. And I found one, and I was engaged to her, and then she left me, married somebody else, and left him, and then she needed to sober up. So being as she was obviously an alcoholic, because she clanked when she walked, because she had bottles in her pockets, I took her to an AA meeting, and I decided the day before that I probably ought not to have any of my drinks, because I'd smell bad, and those poor alcoholics would get upset. So I took her to the AA meeting, and she saw somebody we knew, and she said, you can't stay here. We know him. You have to go to the other place. And I went around the corner to the Al-Anon meeting. And it was a little weird, because I lived at my grandmother's house with my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, and a live-in maid. And the live-in maid said, oh, you're going to AA? You'll need one of these. And she handed me this ratty-looking book. It had rubber bands around it and scotch tape and I think dog urine, I'm not sure, but it was a mess and it smelled bad and pages were hanging out of it. And she said, they use this. I said, oh. So I took it with me and I went to the AA meeting, as I said, and got thrown out basically, sent down the hall for the other people. And I went down the hall and it was a room full of blue-haired ladies. And then there was one dark-haired lady and one young man. I thought he was young. He was about my age. I was 34. And he was about 36. And there was a space beside him, and I sat there. His name was Ernie. And I had in my hand, it turns out, an ODAT. Not an AA book, an ODAT. And I put it down, and being a good little adult child, I felt right at home. Mom. Everywhere I looked was Mom. You know? And I felt like I was 14. Of course, I felt like I was 14 since I was 14. So the fact that there were some 50-year-old women there and some 60-year-old women there and maybe a 49-year-old woman there and holding, they were all Mom. Ernie was not fooled. Ernie smiled at me, and he ran the meeting. And he ran the meeting on Easy Does It, I remember. And it took about 20 seconds to figure out how this works. There's a thing in the back of the book with numbers, and I found Easy Does It, and I counted, and I figured I'm going to read the 16th page or whatever it was, and I counted, and I read the page while somebody else was talking, figured out something brilliant to say about it. It got to me. I was brilliant. And some poor woman said, oh, it's so good to have a man come to the program who's got program. How long have you been coming to Al-Anon? And I said, this is my first meeting in Ernie Lynn. Because he knew. And at the break, he said, we suggest three things. And these are good things for anybody in any 12-step program. But it was kind of cool, because I remember them. He said, we suggest that you come to six of these meetings as quickly as possible so that you can figure out that you weren't fine when you got here, and we didn't make you crazy. We suggest that you get a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? And he said, well, somebody who's been in the program a little longer than you and somebody who remembers what it's like and can help you work through the steps. And then he said something really valuable. He said, and it's somebody that you would never, ever, under any circumstances, want to have a date with. And I said, oh, would you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. And then he said, and then you should go to an AA meeting, not necessarily because you might have a drinking problem, but if you go to AA, here's one thing you'll find out, is that there's a program that does you if you do it. just, it gets in there and it does something. And you'll hear people say, I came here and I was dying, and I showed up, and I'm not dying anymore. I don't know how it works, but it works really well. And you'll hear that in AA and you'll know. Now, what he seemed to know was that I knew I was dying. And I wasn't dying of alcohol. Alcohol was what kept me from feeling about the fact that I was dying. I was dying when I walked into that meeting, not with any alcohol in me. I was dying of this disease. I grew up in an alcoholic family and didn't even know it was an alcoholic family. I'm not stupid, but I had no other family that I was growing up in to compare it to. Everything that happened in my alcoholic family, I was told over and over again, this is the way it's supposed to be. There's something wrong with you. If you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. If you don't understand it, there's something wrong with you. And I learned very quickly a number of things. And not because they were written on the refrigerator, but because you learn things by punishment. You learn things by, ooh, that doesn't work. And I grew up in this family and had no idea what I was learning. And what I was learning is how to be a really good person to suffer from alcoholism and find ways to not feel it. To give you an example, I learned not to feel anything. I learned not to notice what I was feeling, not to allow it to show up where I could tell what it was, and to push it down and hide it very quickly. And one of the things I can remember is my grandfather decided I needed to go to a wake. I was 4, maybe 5. And we go to a wake for somebody who worked in his store, and we walk. I've never been to a wake. I'm a Protestant. We don't do wakes. We do cocktail parties, you know. And this is a wake. This is a full-fledged, full-boat, pedal-to-the-metal Irish wake with a person in the living room in a box. And I'm 4, and I don't know what's going on. And my grandfather says, now, don't be frightened, and don't be scared. There's nothing wrong. The lady's just sleeping. I'm 4 years old. I walk into this room. There's definitely something wrong. This lady is not sleeping. But what do I act like? A 44-year-old funeral director. I'm so sorry for your loss. I went down the line like I've done this 1,000 times before, because it only took 2 seconds for me to figure out what I'm supposed to do to fit in. And it's insane. I should have been screaming like a banshee, get me out of here. But by 4 years of age, I knew, you find out what you're supposed to feel and you feel that. That's scary. By 4 years of age, I knew, no, don't feel. And that's part of the 4 rules that I learned. Don't talk. Richard, don't laugh. They had decided, having taken my inventory when I was in the bathroom, that I'm a talker. My nickname in AA was walkie-talkie. I'm a talker, but I never talked about anything important. I talked about stuff. Stuff to make me fit in. I talked about Harley Davidsons. I hate motorcycles. I talked about baseball. I never played it. I was never any good at it. I talked about football, I talked about sports, I talked about the weather. I learned as much as I possibly could, to the point where my daughter and I played Trivial Pursuit, and she got 5 questions to my 1, because I have a trivial knowledge base. I can chameleon, I can turn into whatever you need me to be. That's not healthy, because I don't know what I'm supposed to be, I just know what I think you need me to be. And I learned, don't talk about anything important. Don't talk about your feelings, don't talk about what's bothering you. Don't talk. So I talked about junk. Next one is, don't tell. Don't tell anybody what happens in this family. Don't tell anybody else. Blood's thicker than water. That's an important thing. The only people you can trust are your family. They're always going to be there for you. Well, they're always going to be there. But, you know, that meant, great, I can't talk to my mother about what's bothering me, and I can't tell anybody else what's bothering me. I'm alone, and I'm 5. There's nobody to get help from. Don't trust is the 3rd rule. And remember, these are not written on the refrigerator. These I learned because when I broke them, something bad happened. Not that I got beat up. Usually what bad happened was chill, like the wind outside, only coming from parents and grandparents and relatives. So let's see. Don't trust. Don't trust anybody, because they'll let you down and then you'll look stupid and it'll be brought up for the rest of your life. But the flip side of that is, you got to be Superman. You got to be willing to drop whatever you're doing, Charlie, and roll up your sleeves and be whatever this other person needs you to be. Because, you know, if you have an active alcoholic in your life, you never know when you're going to be needed to bail someone out, to break the piggy bank, to go drive and pick someone up, to fix a flat tire, to explain something, or in the case of my girlfriend that I was dragged away AA meetings, dragged away to AA meeting. I always had to drop what I was doing. Interestingly, jumping forward, that girl looked at me one day. We were both drinking and both in the cups, and she turned to me and said, "You know, without me, you'd be nothing." She was right, and I knew what she meant. I don't ride horses. Ask me about horses. I can train your horse. Seriously. And I don't ride horses. I'm a little scared of them. That's scary. I wrote a book on training horses for her to give to her instructor. And he took it. And he published it. I don't ride horses. This is a scary situation when you can train somebody's horse and not put a leg over it. You know, there are a lot of us adult children out there teaching people how to do stuff they can't do. It's very scary. So don't trust. But the worst one, and this is the killer, and I'm serious, this kills people. Don't feel. Richard almost cried. I'm almost crying now. Because not to feel will kill me. It will kill me. I have to be able to feel because I can't push it down. And I learned how to push it down for a long time. When I was in fourth grade, I think it was, it first blew up. I had been pushing this feeling down, these feelings down, the anger, the rage, the fear, all that's the sadness. I was allowed to be depressed in my family because it's quiet. But I was not allowed to be joyous. I was not allowed to be sad. I was not allowed to be angry. Depressed, fine. Put them all together in a lump, go up to your room, go in the basement, be quiet. Grandma liked that. Mother liked that. Didn't cause a problem. But in fourth grade, the bully in the school cut the bubbler line, and that's not something that's cool in grammar school when the water's hot for the first 25 minutes of recess. And I took him down. And I was tiny. And he was huge. He'd been in sixth grade for 9 years, you know. And I nearly killed him. And when they pulled me off that kid, I was scared. I didn't know where that came from. I exploded. I didn't know where that came from. It didn't happen again until I was in high school. And in high school, I was the artsy-fartsy guy. I was the dancer, the Madrigal group guy. And I was in acting. I was in art. In fact, I didn't have a girlfriend for 2 years because everybody thought I was gay because I did everything that they thought gay people did back in the 60s. You know, ballet, Madrigal. I mean, it just seemed logical. And plus, my roommate didn't like me, so he told all the girls I was gay. But which really annoyed me when I got to college and a girl said, "I had a crush on you." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, but they said you were gay, so too bad." But anyway, this football player came into my room, and I said, "Hey, it's after lights out. Get out of the room." I was a senior. He was a junior, but he was still the size of a brick wall. And he said, "Yeah, what are you going to do if I don't?" And he said, "I'm going to kick you in the ear." And he didn't get out of the room, and I kicked him in the ear. And they took him to the hospital. And again, the most frightened person in that school was me, because I thought I was a sweet guy. Where did this come from? I mean, I kicked him to kill him. Where did that come from? And if I get scared enough about my fears, who do I have to put out of its misery? It's me. You know? And suicide would like fly through my head all the time. Like, maybe I should just die. Maybe I should just die. As if it was a solution to something. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a method. And there's so many things in my life that were like that. I didn't know what was wrong. And I was coming up with a solution for what I didn't know was wrong. And first thing that I came up with was, well, I'll get an alcoholic as a girlfriend and marry her, and then I won't have a problem. She'll have a problem. I mean, it wasn't logical like that, but that's what I was trained to do to make me feel better, was have somebody who's having major problems, and then I don't have to have any problems. I don't have to deal with anything I'm feeling. I only have to deal with what she's feeling because I'm not allowed to feel. Top of that is also, I was the second child in my family. So anything I thought up was useless. My brother was the hero in the family, and he had the correct answer to every problem. He had the correct solution to every dilemma, and I didn't. no matter what the solution was. And I'll give you an example of how twisted that is. He won the spelling bee when he was in sixth grade. Everybody in the family remembered that. For years I was, you know, your brother won the spelling bee. I won the same spelling bee in fifth grade, and I didn't believe it. And my mother said, oh no, you won the spelling bee in fifth grade. And I go, that was Bill, he won it in sixth grade. She said, I know, but you won it in the fifth grade. No, because I'm not the smart one. My brother is. Ask anybody, especially him, he'll tell you. And I just had no idea that my life was full of all kinds of things where it didn't count. I didn't count. And that's the way I lived my life, really, was if you don't count, you got to do something about it. And since you count, I was trained that you count more than I do, for sure, I got to find one of you and take care of you. Now, that's not a bad thing to take care of somebody, help them. But I like the T-shirt that says, I'm sorry, if you keep helping me, I'm going to have to kill you. that's sort of the way it got with me. And when I got into the program of Al-Anon on that Sunday night, on Monday night I went to another Al-Anon meeting. On Tuesday I couldn't find the Al-Anon meeting. On Wednesday I went to an AA meeting with Ernie. And as a doctor, I think it was Dr. Paul, said, alcoholism is a virus, you catch at meetings and your head starts to do this. And I hadn't had a drink since Saturday night. And I don't know how come, because I never had gone a day without a drink at that point. But something had changed. Something got in there, and by the time I got to that AA meeting, my head was going like this. And I went, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. He sounds like I wish I could get out. Now, I got to explain something. I'm from Massachusetts. And I ought to be talking like this because I'm from Massachusetts, and I should be able to say things like pack your car and I have it yet. And if you're from South Boston, then you ought to talk like this because you're from South Boston, you know. Yeah. And most people cannot understand what you're saying if you're from South Boston, and I couldn't understand people from South Boston. And my head is going like this, as a guy from South Boston is going, I don't tell you my silent, and oh my God, I was in there and the water's up to the side of the car and I'm thinking, I'm so ashamed and I feel like horse manure. And I'm going, yeah. Because I didn't need the details. I did not need to know what brand car he drove. I didn't need to know how much money he made. I needed to know that somebody was alive and okay now. Was ashamed and guilty and felt like horse manure. Because that's how I always felt, and I couldn't tell anybody. And this guy could say it, and I could hear it through all that accent. It was amazing. And I went to my next Al-Anon meeting, and my sponsor's wife, by the way, had 18 years. Her sponsor had 20-some years. She used to call Lois up, I guess, and complain about her husband. And and I walked into the meeting and I said, hi. And she said, hi. And she said, you look funny. And I said, you know what I found out? And she said, what? I said, I found out I'm an alcoholic. And she said, oh, you can't be an alcoholic. You're too nice. Now, I'd had a week of Al-Anon. And I knew alcoholics aren't bad people. They're sick people. And I didn't understand what she was talking about. And I went to my sponsor in Ernie. He was so funny. He said, you know, people don't go to meetings because they're well. Really? He said, yeah, and you're never going to be well. Don't try to be well. Well isn't going to work. You wouldn't know well if it bit you. I said, what do you mean? He said, you don't know what normal is. You don't know what well is. Stop trying to be that way. We got something for you to do. It's called a program. And Ernie took me through this program. And that's it. I guess if I had a message today, it's that Al-Anon isn't attitudes, and it isn't slogans, and it isn't this, and it isn't that. It's a simple process. And when I came to Al-Anon, you never knew what you were going to see in a meeting. Somebody might have a big book. Somebody might have an ODAC. Somebody might have a bunch of poems that they pulled out of a book, like, I don't know, some religious reader or something, and they read a section that was important to them. But I remember reading the big book at Al-Anon meetings and reading the AA step book at Al-Anon meetings, because what was important was, when we arrived in Al-Anon in 1981 and wanted to get better, we had to assume, if I want to get better, there must be something wrong with me. And that was the message Ernie kept pounding into my head. What's wrong is not out there. What's wrong is something's wrong with me. I have a disease, It's a family disease, fine, it's a disease, it's tag, you're it, it's not your fault, and we have to do something to treat this disease. And guess what kind of disease it is? I don't know. He said, you remember when they say the spiritual side of the program? I said, yeah. He said, there's no other side. This is a spiritual program, right? He said. That's all it is. It's a spiritual program. Well, I don't understand. He said, real simple. Can you stay sober? Yeah. Really? When did you start staying sober? Can you solve your problem with your family? What can you make happen? And I could, and I suddenly realized I couldn't make anything happen exactly the way I wanted it to. I could try, but I was not responsible for the outcome. I was only responsible for the effort, and I was putting all my effort into fixing all you. And it, this is where the effort belonged. I needed to find out what was wrong with me and do whatever it was that was needed to make that better. Brilliant. And he said, you're powerless, your life is unmanageable, and you have to figure that out and know it deep in your gut. It has to travel from here down to here. And once you've got that message, then you say to yourself, well, gosh, if I'm not okay, and I need help, and I can't fix all this stuff, who's going to do it? And that's where this program came in. They gave me instructions, they told me what to do, and I followed those instructions. But I'll tell you, this was not easy. You know, I cried for 6 months, and some of the things that used to take place, my Lord, Ernie didn't like Kleenex, and I would start to cry, and all of my mothers in Al-Anon would start finding their Kleenex and sending it down to fix me. And Ernie would take it and throw it. Just throw it like this. And I'd be crying, and he would say, it's not counting, it's not going to count until there's snot. It's not counting until there's snot. And I go, what? And I, because I'd have tears, and my nose would be running. But he'd say, it's not going to count until it's snot. And then people would say, well, he's falling apart. Don't you think you should take him out in the hall? And he'd say, he's not falling apart. He's coming together, and it's painful. And that's the thing is, of course, if I don't want pain, and I was brought up in an alcoholic family, I learned that if I'm in any pain, I'm doing something wrong. I should fix that. How could I fix that? Well, I could drink, I could drug, or I could find an alcoholic. And then they would be more painful than me, and I wouldn't have to feel my pain. And boy, that worked for a long time until it stopped working. Just like any other drug that any alcoholic is, or addict has dealt with. Same thing, it stops working. And I start to get panicky. I was nuts before I came to Al-Anon. I remember getting a call from a total stranger in the middle of the night. You don't know me, but so-and-so knows you, and she said that I should call you because my friend so-and-so that you don't know is having trouble with her girlfriend, and they need someone to go over and straighten it out. And I went to a total stranger's house at 3 o'clock in the morning to discover two 40-year-old women arguing in the kitchen, both of whom were carrying knives. Big, what do you call them? Chef's knives. I walk in, and they look at me, and suddenly, guess what? It's two against one. And they're chasing me around the kitchen table. I don't know these people, and I'm going to fix it. This is good training I had in my family. Alcoholism was a curriculum, and my house was the school. And all I needed was a good excuse to pick up a drink or something else. And I could have picked up anything. I could have picked up food or lack of food or gambling or sex or any number of things. And it would have been that much longer for me to find this program. In fact, I want to jump back to my little history in adult children. That first Monday meeting that I went to was a big meeting. The meeting was almost as big as this group. And it was mostly mothers, with a few of their daughters in that meeting, and me and Ernie and his wife and a few others. And I know I was 34 years old, going on 14, and I wasn't that interested in a girlfriend who was 50, or even 34. But the 20-year-olds seemed very appropriate. I mean, they were close enough to my age so I could consider that maybe I could get a girl in this meeting. It would be nice. And they were funny. As soon as they started reading the welcome, we who have lived or have lived with a problem of alcoholism understand, as perhaps few others can, and at about that point, about 8 young women would get up and leave. And they never came back until after the break. So at the third meeting, I followed them to know where they went. And they went in the kitchen. And they sat in the kitchen with cups of coffee and they had their own meeting. And they talked about stuff. And they didn't read any openings or anything. They just talked about how they couldn't sit in the room with their mother and listen to what mom was saying without fuming. I said, why? Because I didn't have a mother in the program. They said, because they're delusional. I said, what? That's not what happens in my house. That's not how it goes. She's just as crazy as, and all this kind of stuff. All this anger at the parents. And I was like, oh. Now, I wasn't so interested in that, except for the fact that in this room there were no people who could be my mother. These were, I thought, approachable women. I had no idea that I was 15 years older than them, and they had no interest in me as a male whatsoever. But we started talking, and I had some of the same feelings that they had, and some of the same attitudes that they had. And at some point or other, somebody said, why don't we start our own meeting? And that sounded like a great idea until one of their mothers found out and came in and said, you can't. And we said, what do you mean we can't? You can't start a meeting. You belong in that meeting. And they said, no, we want to start our own meeting. Well, you can't. And all hell broke loose. They told the church, you can't have a second meeting in the same building. They told the kids they couldn't have a meeting. But by this time, the word had spread, and we had 20 people. And we met in the stairwell, because it was the only place the church didn't care whether anybody sat in. And then somebody called our bluff and said, you can't sit in the stairwell. It's not safe. So we found another building, and we started an adult children meeting in that building. We didn't know that that's what it was called. We just started an Al-Anon meeting. And then a woman showed up from OA with a sheet of paper in her hand and said her therapist said she should go to Al-Anon. And she stumbled into our meeting instead of the other meeting. And she said, well, he says I'm an adult child of alcoholism. And we all went, what? What was that? Adult child. Adult child. Say that again. And she kept saying it over and over and over. Adult child of alcoholics. Adult. That's what we are. We aren't non-spousal relations. And we're not young people. And now we are adult children. That's what we are. And this was late 81, early 82. And slowly but surely, we started growing. And we had 60 people wedged into this little room. And we split off. We had another meeting on Sunday night. And we discovered an interesting thing. When you have a really emotional meeting, children of alcoholics have tape delay, like radio stations. And Monday is all of a sudden, oh my God, I feel horrible. So you need a second meeting. If you have a really good meeting, you need to have a second meeting 24 hours later for everybody to come in and say, I had a horrible day and I don't know why. Because we're very unused to feeling what we're feeling. And today I can feel what I feel. I can be joyous. I can be so joyous I cry. I can be so sad I cry. I can be so joyous that I laugh hysterically. I couldn't do that when I got here. I remember touching the front door of my house, having gotten a good grade at school, and I don't remember what it was in, but as soon as I touched that door, I don't remember what I felt, because I had to go inside and check it out. You know? And what did I learn? I'll give you an example. My sponsor looked at me one day and he said, you know, you do everything backwards. You know, this is not helpful. I said, what do you mean everything backwards? He said, you know the steps? And I said, yeah. We've been doing the steps all along, but I didn't know. And he said, I think you do the steps backwards. I said, really? He said, yeah. Go home and work on it. And I did. And this is how it worked. As I told you, we used the AA step book sometimes in Al-Anon. And here's how it goes. The first thing I need to know when I come here is that you folks understand what's wrong with me because you've had it too and you're not having it anymore. And that's what it says in the AA step book. In one little line, it says, you no longer feel like a square peg in a round hole. You'll know that you belong in God's scheme of things. You'll have a purpose in life. Now in AA and in Al-Anon, there's a primary purpose. And Richard knows it verbatim. But the primary purpose is real simple. I need to get this program down, be recovered, and help another. And there's processes to do that. In AA, the process is real simple, 12 steps. In Al-Anon, the process is real simple, 12 steps. If I do the 12 steps, I'll be fine. And what it said here is, that's why you should do this program, is because we used to be just like you and you're not going to feel that way anymore. And my sponsor said, get down on your knees every night and ask, how'd I do? And I said, who do I ask? And he said, ask your higher power. I said, well, what do you mean a higher power? He said, you need a power greater than yourself. I said, oh, I don't know about that.
He said,
He said, go get a pine cone. Why are there pine cones on these tables? He said, get a pine cone, put it on the table. And he said, what made that? And I'm a wise ass, so I said, pine tree. He said, great. What made the pine tree? And I knew he had me. And I said, I don't know. He said, whatever has that, whatever does that, whatever can. There's no country, there's no person, there's no company. These are miraculous. I don't know how they're made, but they make pine forests. Whatever makes that, start with that, and you'll build a higher power as we do the steps. The 11th step is real simple. You get down on your knees at night, and you say, how would I do? And you get up in the morning and say, what should I do? That's what I did. And after doing that about 3 weeks, I started realizing I've been doing horrible things to people. I'm being mean and nasty and horrible. That's the 10th step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. I didn't have a higher power to have conscious contact with. So I immediately slip into, what's wrong with me? 10th step, I'm doing an inventory every day. Well, I better go apologize to these people. The first person I want to pick, of course, is a girlfriend that I'm no longer with, and she doesn't want to talk to me. And my sponsor says, that's not really the 9th step. That's sort of like asking for a date. And he said, you have to be willing to make real amends to these people. And I wasn't willing. He said, well, you better. Why wouldn't you be willing? Well, what if, and what if, and what if? And he said, those are character defects. You need to get rid of those. You need to have God take those away. That's the 7th step. Well, all of them? Yeah, including lust. I wasn't so willing to have that happen. And he said, you know, you have to look at what it is that's wrong with you, and there's a core thing that's wrong with you. I didn't want to look. He said, well, look at your life in the past. See what you've done. See what's happened to you. See the times where you have blocked yourself off from God, from a higher power, from whatever makes this. And, I started to look, and I got really scared. Because I was a horrible person, and I thought I was a sweetie pie. Bad things happened to me, but that's not the point. The point is, I did bad things too. I did sweet bad things. I did bad things to get stuff. I did bad things to make you think I was sweet. I was not a nice guy, it turns out. When I was 7, I was not sweet, you know. But I thought I was. And I needed to get rid of all those beliefs about me. I needed to do a 3rd step, which says, you know, whatever you are, I need you to run everything because I screw it up when I run it. I need to let you take care of everything I do so that I can do what you want me to do, whatever you are. You higher power thing, you pine cone maker person thing. But I don't know if I really believe in this. And he says, oh, you know, you'll come to believe if you do these steps. You will come to believe that it's worked for us. It's worked for the people in this room. Maybe it'll work for you. Bet it will. But I can't make anything. I've tried all my life to make stuff work, and nothing works. What am I supposed to do? He said, you can't do anything until you admit that, until you know that, and until you stop trying to make things work. Step 1. I'm powerless over alcohol, over you name it. And my life is unmanageable, not because of alcohol. Because it's not my job to manage my life. If it was, there'd be another step that says, okay, Charlie, take it from here. And there is no step that says that. There's no step that asks me to ask God to give me a little assistance here and there. It says in the 7th step, we humbly ask God to remove. Not to help me remove, but to remove my shortcomings. And I think that that's a key thing for me, is that this program is spiritual. And I thought it was sort of spiritual. I thought it was a little spiritual. Every single problem that I've had in my life has been spiritually solved. Especially if I don't get involved with it. And I'll close with a little couple of stories. I was at a meeting once, and this woman walked into the meeting, and it was an AA meeting, it was a step meeting, and we were doing step 3. Step 3 is a wonderful meeting, a wonderful thing, and it was an open AA meeting. So there were people there from Al-Anon, there were people there from other programs, and there were people there from AA. And this woman walked in who didn't belong there. This is New England fall, and she had a tan like she was from Hawaii, and it turned out she was from Hawaii. And she was there for one simple reason. She had come to Boston to have her kidney checked out. She only had one left, and she had a very rare blood type. And they had told her, she said, at this meeting, there's nothing we can do. There's not enough people in the world with your blood type for us to be sure that we can put you on dialysis or get a match. Sorry. And this woman leaned forward at the meeting and said, what's your blood type, honey? And she said, no, seriously, what's your blood type? And the girl spouted out this long, weird blood type that I never heard of. And the woman leaned back and said, that's my blood type. Would you like a kidney? So, when you're having trouble with the taxes, or you're having trouble with your auto mechanic, or you're having trouble with your spouse, or you're having trouble with your children, you try to arrange something like that. Because this woman got lost and found this AA meeting. There were five rooms she could have gone into to sit down at. Each room was doing a different step. She walks into a room where there's 10 or 12 people, and the woman who leaned forward was a nun. You pull that off. And that kind of thing's happened to me over and over again. My daughter got into college. She shouldn't have gotten into college. She stole the application, mailed it in a Hallmark card envelope with a check, and said, I just want to get the opportunity to apply and go through the process like everyone else. The person at the college who got the envelope was the dean of admissions. The dean of admissions called her up and said, come on over, we'll have lunch. When was the last time you heard of somebody having lunch with the dean of admissions for their college interview? So, as she walks in the door, the dean says, you are so in. Sit down. We have to talk. The next week, this woman that did that shows up at a meeting that I happen to be chairing. And I didn't know her. She didn't know me. And as we're talking, she said, wait a minute, what's your name? And I said, Charlie. And she said, do you know so-and-so? And I go, yeah, she's basically my kid. She said, you don't have any idea who I am, do you? And I said, no. She said, I'm the dean of admissions at such and such college. You pull that off. You organize that. You run that. Is that a coincidence? Is that me being really cool? Or is that what always happens if I'm not in the way messing it up? And that's what I found, is that the spiritual problem that I have is, I think I'm God. I think I should be. I think I'll do a really good job. And from that comes all my fears, all my selfishness, all my dishonesty, all my anger. And I can't be angry if I know God really, really, really wants the best for everybody, even if it's painful sometimes. And that's what I've discovered here. And pine cones, that's pretty miraculous. I don't know if anybody heard me last night at an Al-Anon meeting mention pine cones, but all of a sudden they're everywhere. Thank you. You know, I just want to say, I'm not really even sure how much time I've got left. Am I over, Richard? I got 15 minutes. All right. Well, sometimes it's weird. My internal clock is still on Connecticut time. So let me tell you another interesting little story about what I learned about adult children. Back in 81, 82, I was sort of bashing around. I was in AA, doing okay. I was in Al-Anon, doing okay, doing service work. And my sponsor said, it's time for you to do some more service work. I'm going to put you on the list to go pick up people for AA and drive them to meetings. And so I got a call. And I drove down to pick the guy up, and he was at 7-Eleven, and I pull out, time for the meeting almost. And this guy comes from up around from behind a dumpster and says, what meeting are we going to? And I said, we're going to the hospital meeting down here. And he said, oh, good. And then maybe if you can fix that. And he pulls his coat back, and he's got a big bloody stain, and he's been in a knife fight. He's been out of the detox for 15 minutes, and he's in a knife fight. So I took him to the hospital. The police came. My sponsor said, you're not so good with the detox crowd, huh? I think we'll take you off that list, and we'll find something else for you to do. And his wife happened to be on Al-Anon Public Information at the time, so she said, she can come with me for a while. So I went to lots of places and stood behind tables and handed out pamphlets and meeting lists. And something funny happened. We got asked to speak at a high school, and I went, and one of those ladies from that first meeting went, who was like anybody's grandmother, and me, and then I brought somebody that I knew from the program, this tall, handsome, 6'2", 25-year-old, 23-year-old, somewhere around there, just gorgeous young man, evidently. I wasn't hot for young men or anything, but you could kind of tell when you walked into a meeting all the heads were. And we went and spoke at this high school, and it was kind of fun because we walked in, and the teachers all explained that this auditorium full of about 250 kids was not the kids you want to talk to. They're not going to pay any attention. They won't care what you say. These are our troublesome students. These are the kids you know. And I don't know where it came from, but I said, that's okay. We'll be fine. All the teachers have to leave the room. And they went, really? Now, that wouldn't probably happen today, but 25 years ago or so, they were happy to leave the room and go to the teacher's lounge and wait for a period and a half. What I assumed would happen is that when we spoke, we would get a message across, and then we would have a little question and answer period at the end, and it would be fine. And probably the kids would want to talk to Kevin because he's young. And maybe they'd want to talk to me because I'm extremely knowledgeable. Or maybe the lady because she's female. And what happened was really weird. All the teenage girls lined up in front of me. And all the guys lined up in front of Kevin. And the poor lady was standing there going, I had pamphlets. And this thing ran over time, a long time. You could have heard a pin drop. Number of people from that group, that school, ended up in one or the other or both programs. I go to an AA convention in Massachusetts, and one of the people at one of those talks that we gave shows up. She's got 25 years in AA. She never drank after that day. Pretty freaky. But what was freakiest to me was that line of girls in front of me. Where did they come from? Why? I mean, I was 36 years old. Kevin was 23. You know, he remembered high school. Mine was a dim recollection, you know, pre-Woodstock. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And I didn't know at that point what it was. But I found out as I did the program, as I did the investigation of my past and the investigation of the things I stuffed. And here's what happened. When I was about 5 or 6, not sure how old, I was about that high. I was playing on the beach. And these three teenage girls came over and said, come with us. And I'm from the era when you did what you were told by people who were bigger than you. So I followed them. And they took me around behind a building, and then we went through a board or something and under the building, and it's a blur. And they molested me. And all I remember is being terrified and not daring to cry, because if I cried, they told me if I made any noise, they'd kill me. And then they told me I was going to die in there and nobody would ever find my bones. And then they left. And I don't remember what it felt like at that point. But I do remember deciding to go home and tell someone. I'm back up to where the cottage was. And I started up toward the cottage, and then something went in my head. And this, I think, happens to every child of an alcoholic family, and that is, I'm not going to get help there. And that's what came. I just remember thinking, no, that's stupid. They're not going to let me play on the beach anymore. And I'm still alive, so I turned around and walked right back down to where I had been on the beach, sat down with the same distance from those three girls, and proceeded to continue to play in the sand. And it went away. I stopped it. And I never remembered it until I did the program. Thank God. Because it would have killed me. Not knowing that about me, and not accepting that, and releasing that, would have killed me. One way or another. But what that little kid evidently did was decide, you know what? I'm going to figure out a way so that people who are shaped like that are never going to hurt me again. So I became every teenage girl's dream. I would do whatever they wanted. I'd go get stuff for them. I would ask them what they needed. I would help them out. I would buy them cigarettes. I'd run all the way up the hill to the cigarette machine and put 3/4 in and get a pack of cigarettes and run all the way back down again. I would help them with their boyfriends. I would sit and listen to their tales of woe. I was just their little buddy. Which is fine when you're 7 and when you're 9 and when you're 12. It's not really good when you're 25. Because you're surrounded by teenage girls, and what are you supposed to do with these? And if you're drinking, bad things can happen. And it came pretty darn close. Many times I would find myself, I remember 3 of us were out to eat one night, and there were 3 girls with us, and the waitress came up and said, I'd like to see some IDs, please. I pull up my ID and it says I'm 30. And she went, and she asked the next guy, he's 27, and she says, never mind. And the girls are rummaging in their pocketbooks. And just for fun, we asked them how old they were, and one was 15. And they went, oh my God. Because I was attracting you, I don't know why. Well, I was, there was a double thing going on here. I needed buddies, and I was going to make sure that people shaped like that didn't hurt me. Now, this could have been a killer. I could have been in jail if it had continued. But luckily, my drinking took off, and my attitude changed, and I decided I didn't want anybody in my life. I pulled the shades down, and the only person that I ever dealt with after that was that ex-fiancé. I got sober. I got in the program. I got in Al-Anon. I did the steps. I got sponsors. I got these speaking engagements, and these girls kept showing up all the time. Didn't make any sense to me until I started to redo fourth step, redo fifth step, and this comes up in a therapy session. Because I learned, you ask for help. And when you can't get the help here, you keep asking until you find it, till God puts in your path somebody who knows what's going on. And this guy knew. This guy knew exactly what to say. And he kept saying to me one thing. You can tell I'm a talker. I can make a novel out of one slogan. And he would say, tell me that story again. Tell me that story again. And I told it over and over and over again about the beach. And he said, how did you feel? And I didn't know. And so he helped me. He said, I would have been enraged. And I was. And I didn't know it until that moment. And now you say to yourself, well, now what do I do with that? That's what I love about this program. It tells me exactly what to do about it. And you know where it tells me? In the big book, in the family afterwards. Us, Al-Anon. It says, sometimes the greatest asset a family has is its bleakest times. It may be the only asset that that family has, is the horrors that you've gone through. Because if I tell you what I've gone through, and I'm speaking your language, then you know I'm not BSing you, and you can say, what do I do? Because obviously you've been through this. What do I do? If I don't tell you the truth, if you're a smart COA, you'll back off. You're BSing me. And this thing that was the blackest time of my life has become my greatest asset. And I'll tell you why. I worked at an adolescent treatment center for a year. And because of that place, I took a kid in, a girl, and she got sober. And 10 years later, I said, well, you know, I better sponsor an Alateen group. Actually, what happened was I told somebody else they ought to sponsor an Alateen group, and they said, shut your mouth and do it yourself. So I sponsored an Alateen group, and from that Alateen group, two kids got clean and sober. One of them came to live at my house. She said, you know what? I know who you should deal with. And she brought another girl to live at the house. And then that girl brought a boy to live at the house. And over the last 15 years, I've had 7 different people come and live at my house and get sober, starting as mid-teenagers, 15, 16, 17. And most all of them are sober or really close to being sober on a regular basis now. And they know this program inside and out. They can take you through the steps in a blink. They're amazing. Because they understand that what we're trying to do here is change. That it's not fault, it's a disease. That it's not stupidity, it's a disease. It's not weak character, it's a disease. And they are amazing. I was just on the phone with one this afternoon. She should be dead. She's 11 years clean and sober. And she's sponsored a number of people, and she's pulled a number of people into the program and handed them off to other people. She's taken her mother to Al-Anon, her mother's taken her to Al-Anon. She's just up to her eyeballs in 12 steps. And that's what this is all about. I cannot be okay if I don't learn the steps and then do the steps and then show you what I know. I'm amazed sometimes when I see people over the years who think that if I just go to meetings, I'll be fine. That isn't my experience. My experience is if I go to meetings, I'm going to get frustrated. I'm going to get angry. Because I'm not going to have to change by just going to meetings. You know, I know my schedule. I can end up being the person who's gone to that meeting the longest. But if I don't do the steps, I'm not going to reap the rewards. There's a guy named Milt who does a great 2-hour, 3-hour tape on doing the steps. And he talks about pineapple upside down cake. He says, you know, if you're going to make pineapple upside down cake, what do? You get a recipe. We have a recipe. It's 12 steps. There, it's real simple. Just do what it says in there. You know, if you don't do it, you're going to starve. If you don't bake the recipe, you're going to starve. You're going to have half the ingredients. You're going to have glop. You got to do the whole thing. And then once you've done it, you can show anybody in the world how to do it. And I swear to gosh, it's amazing. The people that I met since I got in the program, Janet Wittes, amazing woman. She wrote Adult Children of Alcoholics. Not conference approved. But when you read that book, you go, I know why I need Al-Anon. I know why I need these 12 steps. There are some people who tell you that it's not an Al-Anon book. You know what she says in it? Real simple, real clear, real straightforward. I have nothing against Al-Anon. It only saved my life. That's what it's for. That's what this program is for, saving my life. Claudia Black, it'll never happen to me. Yeah, right. It happened to me. Meeting those people was an inspiration because they knew things because of experience, and they shared their experience. Even though they were professionals in the field, they shared their experience from the gut. My favorite thing to learn was that people don't become social workers because they're healthy. Lots of times people decide to become social workers because they don't like 12 steps and they want to find out what's wrong. I would have if it hadn't been for the grace of God keeping me out of there. And I guess I can close with just this last go-around with the kid. This young lady I met when she was 13 and a half. She was sitting crying on the steps of a church where there was a meeting. And in the meeting were her brother and her sister who were getting sober in AA. And she said, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, what do you mean you're an alcoholic? Really? She said, well, I have alcoholism for sure. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I was playing this video game and I can't stop. And when I was forced to stop, I threw up. My brother cut the cord to the computer and I started to shake and I got sick and I threw up. And all I can think about is this game. And I know if I ever picked up a drink or a drug or anything like that, I'd probably become an alcoholic. What do I do? And I said, it's not weird. I said, we have 12 steps and they will work for you if you use them. Really? I can do that? I said, absolutely. And then somebody told her, you're too young. You haven't had enough to drink. You haven't even tried pot. And so she said, fine, screw you all. And it took her 4 years to finally put it all down again and say, you know what, that's what's wrong with me. And today she's got 36 days after 4 years of bashing her head against the wall trying to stop all by herself. Now think about it. When somebody comes to you, teach them what it is. Teach them the 12 steps. Let them decide whether it's working or not. But teach them exactly what it is that they need to do. I'm powerless. You know, when I did those steps backwards and I realized I can't do anything, it was the first sane thing I ever realized in my life. I am totally powerless. I'm powerless over the clock, the weather, my body, everything. I'm powerless. End of discussion. And when I try to be powerful, I'm insane. Which is the second step. And now I'm off and running. I have to have whatever made this, or I'm dead meat. If there's anybody new here, anybody who's not been around Al-Anon for a long time, I want you to know a lot of stuff that I said is opinion, and Al-Anon is really cool. It says, take what works, leave the rest. If it works for you, use it. If it's not working for you, put it aside. Do what you can do, because that's all you can do. I'm not an expert. I don't get paid for this. This is a blessing, because it says I'm supposed to help somebody, and there might be somebody in here who got helped by something I said. If that's true, I didn't do it. I'm just an instrument. I'll close with what my sponsor Ernie used to say. He said, you know, Charlie, if you have an operation and it's successful, do you thank the scalpel? I said, no. He said, who do you thank? The surgeon, the doctor. He said, right. You're not the surgeon. You're the scalpel. So stay sharp and keep coming. Thanks.